slightly different order. I forgot where I was supposed to be next.
It's in your bike tag.
Yes. I should hire someone from my family. I mean, in the mornings, I'm especially nervous. Okay, you hear me okay? So, yeah, there'll be some things about joining and membership and what that feels like in today's sermon as well, which wasn't planned. It wasn't planned to go with a new member welcome, but here you go. The first revelation, which is like a step towards membership, was a terrifying experience for the Arab businessman Muhammad ibn Abdullah. It sent him fleeing home in distress and fearing for his sanity. As a prelude, we're told that he used to go in seclusion to a cave on Mount Hira, where he would fast and pray for days on end. And then suddenly, this is the oldest record of this event, translated directly from Arabic. Suddenly, one day, the truth descended on him. That's just what it says. The truth descended on him while he was in the cave. It was in the month called Ramadan in the year 610 by our calendar. Today is the first day of Ramadan by the Muslim calendar. An angel came and commanded him, "Read." The prophet tells us that I replied, "But I don't know how to read." He was illiterate. Then the angel seized me and pressed me so hard that I could not bear it anymore. Then he released me and said again, "Read." And again I replied, "I don't know how to read. I don't know how." Again he seized me and crushed me until I couldn't take anymore and said, "Read." Again I said, "I can't read." Then he seized and crushed me until finally I said, "What should I read?" And he said, "Read. In the name of your Lord who created humankind from a clot of blood, read, and your Lord is most generous." Then the prophet rushed home to his wife Khadija with his heart beating severely and lay down on the floor and said, cover me up, zaminuni, zaminuni. And the people inside covered him with blankets until his fear began to pass. Then he told her everything that had happened and said, "I fear for my mind, my sanity." It was a great dishonor to be mad in old Arab society. Khadija replied, "Never, never would God disgrace you that way. You keep good relations with your kinfolk and neighbors. You help the poor and victims of calamity and serve your guests graciously. God would not afflict a man like you with madness." He was 40 at the time that he rushed out of that cave in distress. She was 55, 15 years older, much more experienced. She'd also been his employer before they married. She suggested that when he felt better, they should go talk to someone who might help them make sense of it all. If they hadn't, one out of four human beings might not be beginning their month of fasting today. In memory of Muhammad's fasting in seclusion in that cave so long ago, also in celebration of the arrival of a new holy book into our world, and yes, last but most important, also for a chance to, quote, feel in your body for a month every year what the poor feel every day. That's the plan. The command to read was the first word of the Quran. And I'll be reading some more in a few moments. But for now, instead of reading, let's listen together. Thank you. Well, I've only ever had to rush out of a room in distress once in the past, maybe 35 years. It was during a retreat for ministers of an extraordinarily well-meaning religious movement, which shall remain nameless for now. Someone was leading the participants in what they billed as a Sufi dance and had asked everyone to begin with a chant they didn't explain, a chant in Arabic, La ilaha illa Allah, Muhammad Rasul Allah. I didn't leave because of the dance. It was sweet and performed with the best of intentions. I didn't leave because I'd studied Arabic and knew that the pronunciation was bad. My pronunciation is not perfect either. My problem was that these well-intended religious leaders had all just changed religions without knowing it, and I wasn't ready to take such a step myself. At breakfast the next morning, I teased several of them about the bacon and pork sausages on their plate, foods which are prohibited for Muslims. Of course, they hadn't really meant to become Muslims, but the night before, they'd done pretty much what you're supposed to do if you want to profess Islam as your religious faith. Okay, I'm overstating things a little. Islam teaches that before doing or saying anything so important, you must first form the niyat, or intention, to do so in your mind. Right? Otherwise, nothing really happens. Right? Nothing really. It's just saying words. Right? Nothing really happens. So my colleagues hadn't really converted without meaning to. You can't really do that. Nor can you be converted by the sword, nor under any coercion whatsoever. Not legitimately. La ilaha illa Allah, Muhammad Rasulullah, are the words of the Shahada, the testimony of faith. There is no God but God. Muhammad is the messenger of God. These are powerful words, starting with what's called the La, or La, the no of absolute negation, a grammar form that's unique to Arabic. La ilaha. No God. There is absolutely no God. It's a kind of spiritual house cleaning. Or in honor of Ramadan, let's say, a fast. Take a break. Stop consuming all those weird versions of God that are pushed on us like fast food, those empty calorie gods, those idols with soda pop sloshing around in those hollow feet of clay. Empty yourself of gods to make room for God. First the fast, then the feast. Don't hurry it. Stay with no as long as necessary. Don't rush to the yes too quickly, and don't do it unless you mean it. There is no God, no God, no God. Our own religious movement undertook a long fast like this around the time that the Universalists and the Unitarians formed an association in 1961. For several decades, we made it very difficult to speak of God at all. This was an important step for us. We felt we had people who were active in the movement back then. Remember, you better be careful if you said that word, right? We felt we'd had quite enough of God, the punishing father, who seemed all too often to exult in slaughter and suffering in a diet of human flesh and blood. We rushed that God out of our churches and fellowships straight to the garbage. In recent years, though, we've cautiously opened our doors again to religious language and made a place for it at our tables. We still make no promises that we'll believe it, of course. That's fine. That's a different matter. But now back to the Shahada. No God, if not the God. That's the first part. The second part of the Shahada sets up another radical encounter, but this time it's with a human being and a message. Muhammad Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger of God. It's how it's usually translated, but it sounds more exclusive than it should be. Jesus is also Rasulullah. So are Moses and Abraham, David, and others. Rasulullah, messengers of God. Islam insists that Muhammad was a human being, born the natural way, living an extraordinary life to be sure, but then dying a very human death. No ascent to heaven, no transformation or glowing light or wings and things. No return. That is, not until all of us return for Judgment Day, and Muhammad comes not one day sooner than you or me. The Shahada is an encounter with God and Muhammad. And when you accept that encounter and enter into it willingly, then you become a Muslim. You also accept that every word of the Quran came straight from God through the Archangel Gabriel to Muhammad without change or error, and usually with much less terror than that first time in the cave. It's not a very big book, just a bit shorter than the New Testament. It can be, for as anyone who has tried can attest, a difficult read. Subjects change suddenly. It has strange stage directions included, like read or say or recite, and strange letters that appear without explanation, THYS, and so on. Some people even name their kids, give kids the names. So like Yasin, that means YS, TH, Taha, TH. It's understood, the book is understood to be a series of direct, real-time transcriptions, like a black box flight recorder in the airplane. Here's a very short transcript, a little black box transcript, one that contains just a hint of a description of what happened to Muhammad in the cave. This chapter is known as the Night of Power, and it refers to the night in the month of Ramadan when the Quran first descended on our poor, frightened businessman. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Inna anzalnahu fi laylatul qadr. Wa ma adraka ma laylatul qadr. Laylatul qadr khayrun min alfi shahrin. Tanazzala al-malaikata wa ruh fiha bi'izni rabbihim min kulli amrin. Salamun hiya hatta matba'u fajr. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Indeed, we made it descend on the night of power. But what will explain to you what is the night of power? The night of power is better than 1,000 months. In her, light is feminine, descended the angels and the spirit with the will of their Lord in all matters. It is peace until the rising of the dawn. Last line kind of sticks out there, doesn't it? The last line really makes more sense when we take it as something like an overheard transmission. God is signing off with Muhammad. That's all for now. Message complete. It is peace until the rising of the dawn. Sleep until morning so you're ready for the next message. Okay, we're going to have to keep listening. We're going to have to stay super alert, hyper alert. Take a break. Much of the Quran is just like this. Messages, but very few stories. Nor does it offer much by way of description of the divine. And many of you know that Islam, like Judaism, prohibits any physical representation of God. If stories and pictures are what you're looking for, you will be disappointed. Paradoxically, this lack of pictures illustrates what's one of the greatest strengths of Islam for me. Its insistence that God is not like any human being, not like somebody's father or mother or son or second cousin. I love my family, but I don't want a God who's like even one of my favorite relatives. None of them could handle that. Still, we have to admit that this radically non-anthropomorphic God who speaks in a book without pictures or much story is not an easy God to speak about. Not easy to speak about. It's much easier to speak about Muhammad. Muhammad's book is not one book, but many. These books are called the Hadith, the speeches or happenings. Muhammad didn't really write them, of course. Remember that he's said to have been illiterate. They're records of conversations with statements attributed to and actions taken by the Prophet in his lifetime, as reported by his closest companions and family members. They're also filled with authority, second only to that of the Quran. It may surprise you to hear that the Shahada itself, that profession of faith, is not found in the Quran, but in the Hadith. Hadith are much easier to read. Strings of narratives connecting everything from Muhammad's first experience in the cave to what he did and said on the day that he died. They give us a fuller description of his appearance, habits, and mannerisms than any that we will find for the founders of other great religious traditions. We learn that he was of medium height, had broad shoulders, brown eyes with long lids, a fair complexion that was usually tanned. His hair and beard were thick and black, slightly wavy, and he wore both rather long. When he died in his early 60s, he had just a few white hairs that people tell us would disappear when he oiled his hair. We even hear that he had remarkably slender heels and walked leaning forward as if rushing downhill, even when he was on flat ground. I kind of think of Groucho Marx. I'm not being disrespectful, but leaning forward was something that struck people, and multiple people recorded this. It looked like he was rushing downhill on flat ground. Interesting details. Near the end of his life, he had 12 wives. Some were elderly widows who had nowhere to turn for support when their first husbands died. He had no room or house of his own, but divided his time between the quarters of these 12 women. He was particularly close with his youngest wife, Aisha, whom he married long after his first wife, Khadija, died. We get a lot of information from this very powerful, independent young woman. She reports that in his last days, the Prophet had a high fever and was losing consciousness frequently. She says, the messenger was seriously ill and he asked whether the people had prayed. We said, no, they're waiting for you. He said, put some water in the tub for me. We did accordingly, and he took a bath and he tried to walk, but his feet dragged the ground and he fainted. When he came to, he again asked if the people had prayed. We said, no, they're waiting for you. He again said, put some water in the tub for me. We did as he asked. He took a bath, but when he started to move, he fainted again. When he came to, he asked yet another time if the people had prayed. When we said no, he once more asked for bath water. Again, he bathed, but again, when he tried to go lead the prayers, he passed out. He said like four times. When he next came to, he asked, have the people prayed? I said, no, they're in the mosque waiting for you to lead the night prayer. The messenger then sent for my father, Abu Bakr, and instructed him to lead the prayer. So my father continued to lead the prayers for several days. On one of those days, the messenger of God felt some relief and came to attend the prayers, supported by two men, one on either side. When Abu Bakr saw the messenger come in, he began to withdraw, but the messenger told him with a gesture, stay where he was, and then sat down to follow my father in prayer. The messenger of God signed with his hands to them to complete the prayer. When it was over, he came back to my apartment and drew the curtain. The messenger of God, may peace be upon him, breathed his last on that very day. Do you feel the similarity between this story and the other nighttime story about the angel in the cave, and even in our children's story about the bear? It takes me back to a night in my own life and people in my own family. After my father died, I was raised in my uncle's family, just like Muhammad had been when his parents died. One night, my uncle Carmen, a big bear of a man, began to faint repeatedly after flushing the most intense crimson color I have ever seen on human skin. My aunt and my cousins and I watched as this happened over and over. Each time he came to, we said we wanted to take him to the hospital, call an ambulance, and each time he told us that he would drive himself, but we could come along. This might sound familiar, right? Yeah, come with me if you have to. We couldn't convince him until the last and worst of what turned out to be, yes, a series of heart attacks. He survived that time, but it was close. He didn't survive the next round. The poor old bear. My uncle couldn't bear the thought of not being in the driver's seat so long as he could breathe. Mm. He was the one who was supposed to protect us, to transport us through the world. He couldn't imagine being a passenger in the family car until the choice was ride or die. Muhammad couldn't imagine being a passenger, joining but not leading his community in prayers until there was no choice. Both men feared that without them, the people who they cared for would be somehow all alone, unable to get where they had to go. Fluttering in and out of consciousness, we were the first concern on both men's minds. I've never seen anything so tender, human, and believable as this story about the messenger's last day. In all of the miraculous stories that I've read about the founders of other great religious movements, after what I've told you about my uncle, you'll understand why it touches me. It's okay. I'm up. All right. I'm up. Okay. I'm up now. I can lead the service. Okay, I'm up. It's okay. I think many of us have had moments like these with loved ones. We want them to rest and take care of themselves or just let go while they struggle up from deep water to reassure and take care of us. With an energy that comes from a deeper place even than the determination they brought to running a hard scrabble gas station in Chicago for 35 years, or the energy that makes them walk as if always rushing downhill. Every time Muslims are called to prayer, 5 times daily, 1 out of every 4 people on this planet, they hear the words of the Shahada again. There is no God but God. Muhammad is the messenger of God. These words speak of an encounter with either the God or no God at all, and with a fully human being. As for this human being, I'll skip out of a room before I will speak such words casually or hear them babbled without understanding like some sort of magic spell. Excuse me for now, see you at breakfast tomorrow. It's peace now until the rising of the dawn, and I'll keep my own company till then in my own little cave. But don't forget the importance of table fellowship in religious life. Don't forget the importance of table fellowship, like the food we'll share after the service today. It's just as important as the budget meeting that follows, and just as important as this sermon. And remember that Ramadan is as much about feasting as fasting. There's a little feast every day, just a bit after sundown, then a big one at the end of the month. Take all the time that you need in your favorite cave, but it's hard to fast or feast alone. No God or the God. Fast or feast. We need a little help from our friends to do either one of those, don't we? Muhammad offered himself as a companion to his whole community, a companion in both holy dread and holy joy. And his community responded, and that's something worth remembering. This companionship is the real reason for Ramadan, a companionship that persists even as bodies hunger and age, wear out, and die, and minds or souls begin to flutter in and out of connection with them. Goodbye, Uncle Carm. Goodbye, messenger. Goodbye, bear. Remembering such companionship and such compassionate care is central to every authentic Muslim act of worship, whether individual or in community. How could anyone find this so ugly or threatening that they feel the need to burst in and start shooting. The most compassionate answer I can find is ignorance. Not knowing, and what's worse, not even caring to know. One thing that I do know is that it's time for such ignorance to end. And I want to digress for just a moment. Say, I've been trying to demonstrate something here today. When encountering an unfamiliar religion, you can find one weird detail and stay focused on that while you push the whole mess away. That's so icky. Or you can find something familiar and build on that as a way to understand, or at least begin to. Thanks for letting me digress. Another hadith tells us that long before Muhammad's death, a man asked him, "Messenger of God, where's my father?" The man's father had died as a polytheist, worshiping many gods, right? Like most Arabs before Islam, and like the Prophet's own father. And like little kids, we all wonder where our loved ones have gone when we lose them, even if we don't say so. Well, the Prophet answered that man, "Your father is in the fire." But just as the poor guy started to rush away in distress, the messenger called out saying, "Verily, my father and your father are in the fire." He just couldn't let the man go off feeling so alone. "Your dad's in the fire, yes, but my dad is with him too, okay? You should know that hell in Islam is more like purgatory in the Christian imagination. According to some hadith, all who enter the fire will still be in the presence of God, and most, if not all, can hope to someday rejoin their families." More on that someday in another sermon. In the presence of God, or the absence of God, or even into the fire, may we do our best to assure each other that we're not alone, and never alone. I think that's the message we're waiting to hear. So why not share it with each other today? Maybe as we share that bit of food before our budget meeting. So may it be.